The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. The numbers are pretty startling. Since the branch was established in 1789, only 44 women have served as U.S. senators. Hattie Caraway of Arkansas was the first, and that was in 1932, only after being appointed to the seat when her husband, Thaddeus, died. And it's still no picnic for women who become members of what was for so long a boys' club. There's the males-only swimming pool, a paucity of women's restrooms, sexist comments, and even stories of groping by randy old school members of the distinguished Senate. Liza Mundy wrote The Secret History of Women in the Senate for Politico, and she recently spoke to Virginia about her investigation.
Well, some of these stories, I mean, even recent ones of women trying to bust in sound shockingly archaic. Take Kay Hagan, just wanting to take a swim in the Senate pool. What happened?
Well, when Senator Hagan was elected from North Carolina in 2008 and came up to the Senate before she had been sworn in, members typically come up and they get shown around and acclimated. And she was being shown the Senate gym and caught a whiff of swimming pool. And she said, "Oh, is there a pool?" And they said, "Well, yes, but it's men only." And when she asked why, they responded that some of the male swimmers like to swim in the buff. They like to swim naked. And she got that changed. She had to push back. But, you know, that was 2008, which is just extraordinary.
It does sound as like a story from the 1950s somehow. More well-known is the updating of the women's bathrooms, which was, I guess, a great cause for joy among female senators.
Yes, and it's extraordinary, like the fight for facilities. It's extraordinary how long that has taken. You mentioned Hattie Caraway back in the, you know, pretty early part of the 19th century. Well, she had to use the public restroom along with the tourists to the Capitol because there was nothing for women close to the floor. So more recently, there was a ladies' restroom close to the floor, but it was so small. And even with 20 women senators, which is only one-fifth of the Senate, certainly not a big number, but even with 20, it was starting to get very crowded, and the women had to really fight to get expanded facilities. You know, it has taken a remarkably long time for some basic changes to be made.
Well, those are structural things. Behavioral infractions are an entirely other thing, and sometimes tolerated or even laughed at among other male senators. Can you tell us some stories about that?
I mean, it's important to point out, up until the late 1980s, there had only ever been one or two women senators at any given time. So it had really been an all-male institution for more than 100 years. And when women started coming in you know, still quite small numbers in the early 1990s, there were many male senators who were quite wonderful. And the women, you know, want to make that point. But there were still male senators who were predatory. I mean, Strom Thurmond was notorious and for groping staffers. I mean, you know, up until then, women in the Senate had been largely in subordinate positions, and I think women had been forced to just sort of tolerate roving interests from senators. But even when women senators started coming in, I mean, there was a widely reported story that when Senator Patty Murray was elected, that at one point Strom Thurmond tried to grope her breast on the Senate elevator. And then when Susan Collins of Maine came in the late 90s, she was told to avoid getting on an elevator alone with him. And she recounted to me an incident where she looked up and realized that they were heading toward the same elevator. And she said that she made a U-turn and just went up the stairs, just a sort of a quick decision. And one of her male colleagues just sort of laughed because he knew exactly what she was doing. As she later said to me, you know, he was given a pass, and we all gave him a pass because he was older and regarded as a person of a different generation and had been around forever. But there were a number of legislators who, up until the 1990s, were given passes.
Well, is that the strategy, I guess, or for lack of strategy, just wait until the old dinosaurs die off?
Well, I think that was true in some cases, but you may recall that in the 1990s, there was also the protracted episode in which Senator Bob Packwood, there were allegations by nearly 20 women that he had made advances or accosted them. And there was a prolonged, agonizing number of years in which the Senate wrestled with what to do about these allegations. And ultimately, the Ethics Committee recommended that he be expelled, and he resigned instead. And of course, before that, there was the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill hearings in which she made allegation of sexual harassment when Justice Thomas was up for confirmation. And there was the indelible public televised image of an all-male, all-white Judiciary Committee listening to her charges and, you know, on a certain level, just not getting it. So I think there were some senators who were given passes. But what you saw in the 1990s were some very public, very kind of agonizing situations in which the Senate was sort of reckoning with what had been acceptable in the past and what was no longer acceptable.
Hmm. And those are two events that you point out as really big turning points in the numbers of or the motivation for women who are seeking the Senate. But still, what are we looking at? 20 women now currently holding seats in the Senate?
20 women now. And in fact, there have now been 46 women senators because we lost two in the midterms and gained two in the midterms. So we can now say that 46 women have served or are serving in the Senate, but the current number remains at 20. So that's one-fifth of the whole Senate body.
And you point out in your article that most of the women in the 20th century who served briefly was upon the death of a husband. Now, how did that practice come about?
So, and Hattie Carryway would be one example, but it happened any number of times after her tenure that if a lawmaker died, if a senator died while he was in office, his wife would often be sort of drafted by state political officials to basically keep his seat warm until an actual elected successor, could be elected. But the assumption was always that it would be a male senator and that the wife was just there in a temporary capacity. In Hattie Carraway's case, she was an early example of a woman after a year deciding, you know what, I'd like to run for election. The expectation in Arkansas was that she would step aside after a year, and she decided not to. And she kept a fascinating diary in which she made really sort of tart and interesting observations. She obsessively analyzed what her male colleagues were wearing, what their, you know, their color of their spats that day or the color of their whiskers that day. She was kind of, she was very sharp-eyed, but you could see in her diary a growing enjoyment of being a member of Congress. And also, she needed the money. She needed the salary. I mean, back then, all indications are that a woman was paid as much as a man when she served in the Senate. And that, of course, was unusual for women back then. There weren't very many occupations where a woman could expect to make as much as a man. And her husband had left her in debt and she had lost her house. So she needed the job and she needed the money. But she also increasingly enjoyed what she was doing. But she was an anomaly.
Well, we're pulling back the curtain to perhaps one of the country's most exclusive clubs, the U.S. Senate, an old boy network for a couple of centuries. We're speaking with Liza Mundy. She is a contributing editor at Politico, and she wrote The Secret History of Women in the Senate. So we heard about Hattie Caraway, who really did start to make a difference or really took to the Senate. There is another woman, Margaret Chase Smith, who really became in many ways one of the first modern female senators and the first to denounce McCarthy's tactics on the Senate floor. Was she regarded as a woman foremost or a senator?
Margaret Chase Smith typically would say, I was elected to be a senator, not a woman senator. So she would stress that she was a senator just like everybody else, understandably. But as one of the Senate historians, and the Senate historians are such wonderful resources of history, Betty Coed, who was one of the historians, pointed out to me that behind the scenes, Margaret Chase Smith did a lot for women. She was a member of the Armed Services Committee, and she spoke up for benefits for women military veterans, you know, from the Second World War. And historian Coed said, you know, that she was really the first person to take up the cause of women in the military and their right for benefits and things like that, recognizing their service. And so although Margaret Chase Smith might have, again, understandably wanted to stress that she was a regular, effective senator just like everybody else, she did press women's issues strategically. And one of the reasons that Maine has a tradition of electing women to the Senate is because of the influence of Margaret Chase Smith. Susan Collins speaks movingly about going to the Senate as part of a youth program when she was in high school, and the fact that, to her astonishment, Margaret Chase Smith spent 2 hours talking to her about the satisfactions of public service and public life and what you can achieve. And Senator Collins, when I asked her, you know, was there anybody else on the trip, she mentioned that there was a young man on the trip with her as well, and she did not recall Margaret Chase Smith spending that kind of time with him.
Well, I guess the fear is that with too many female senators, women's issues will get pushed to the floor, right? The idea that there would be a sort of female caucus. Give us a sense of what's going on in terms of a women's caucus today when there's so much partisan division within the Senate.
Right. So the history of the women in the Senate includes a lot of solidarity and I wouldn't say secret meetings, but regular off-the-record meetings, which has an interesting origin. After the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill spectacle, there were a number of women elected to the Senate, Patty Murray, Carol Moseley Braun, Barbara Boxer, Senator Feinstein, also from California. And Barbara Mikulski, up until then, had been either the only senator or one of just two. And so she was ready when all these new women Democrats came into the Senate. She was ready for them with written instructions about how to run an office, how to get on a committee, all the sorts of things that she felt a newcomer needed to know. And she got together with them over breakfast and gave them practically a manual of how to be a senator. And this tradition has been handed down between the women. I was told that when Senator Gillibrand came into office, Senator Feinstein did that for her because they both have big states and have to run big offices. So it wasn't just how to run an office, it was how to run a big office in a big state. And also in the 90s, along the way, there were times when the Republican and Democratic women in the Senate really would work together on issues having to do with women's health, having to do with women's economic security. The women senators were really able to band together on issues like that and push them forward. But I do think that in this current partisan, really partisan environment, it is still true that the women can reach across the aisle to each other, maybe more often than the men, but it is becoming harder, and particularly in the midterms with, you know, hotly contested elections for control of the Senate. You know, there were instances of women senators campaigning against each other.
Right here in New Hampshire, Kelly Ayotte and Jean Shaheen.
Yeah, and that represents a shift from times past, but I think an inevitable one. And You know, ideally, I think we'd all like to see, or many of us would like to see, a Senate with 50 women in it. And in that case, right, I mean, partisan division is going to become inevitable. Campaigning against each other will become inevitable. So, you know, something may have been lost in the current environment, the sort of solidarity of yore. But it may be that we are gradually moving toward a period of time, right, when the women are just like the men, and hopefully a time someday when there are just as many women as men.
Just as long as their behavior isn't the same.
Right, in many respects, yes.
Well, Liza Mundy, fascinating read. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Virginia Prescott speaking with Liza Mundy about her article for Politico, The Secret History of Women in the Senate. Up next, women's rights in the workplace. We'll distinguish fact from fiction and take an unvarnished look at the state of maternity leave in the U.S. Stick around.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. What does the U.S. have in common with Lesotho, Swaziland, and Papua New Guinea? Well, we share the dubious status of being the four countries that don't provide paid maternity leave. At last week's State of the Union address, President Obama asked Congress to pass measures allowing federal workers to earn up to 6 days of sick time that could be used as paid family leave. Judith Barnett is a former senior government official. She's now a lawyer and consultant in international trade. She considers America's unwillingness to provide women paid time off to have children an outrage, and she wrote about it for the Huffington Post. Virginia spoke with her earlier this week.
Well, so what is the current maternity leave policy for federal workers?
Well, in 1993, President Clinton signed the Family and Medical Leave Act. And what that allowed was 12 weeks of unpaid leave for employees, either to care for their newborn or for loved ones. Not a lot for people like single parents, et cetera, who can't take unpaid leave, and not a lot for anybody.
Well, that's the federal policy. How about in the private sector in general? What is the paid maternity leave policy?
Pretty weak. It's about 11%. Of all non-federal or non-government workers can take paid maternity leave of various kinds. You know, on one hand, that's a good thing because 11% get it. On the other hand, some employers have told me that they'll think twice before hiring young women because they'll just take off and take their paid maternity leave.
Wow. Well, we know how pro-family Congress is. How do members of Congress in general feel about paid family or maternity leave?
Basically, they say they like it, but they don't vote for the legislation. So there is a very good bill out by Senator Gillibrand and Representative DeLorio that would allow 12 weeks of paid parental leave. And supposedly everybody, in the 2012 poll says that 88% of Democrats and 73% of Republicans support it, but nobody shows up for a vote. So I guess it sort of is, but it isn't.
So that's proposed legislation by two female Democrats, if I've got it right. Now, how would that be paid for?
Well, they want it to be paid for by a payroll tax. And this is actually something that's done in a couple of the states. There are just a couple of exceptions where family leave is paid through payroll taxes. It's a possibility. I mean, maybe 0.2% or 0.1% could be increased on the payroll tax. And there are many, many ingenious ways of finding money. I've lived in Washington for 40 years, and there are some brilliant people who spend time thinking of brilliant proposals for lots of other things. But when it comes to pregnant mothers and children who I think are our future, people kind of go mute.
Okay. So the president at the State of the Union address, talking to both houses of Congress, and the president at the State of the Union address proposed this 6 days of sick time for that could be used as family leave. Now, how determined is he to get that through? Would this be something that would actually become an item for an executive order, for example?
Well, I mean, I think there are ways that he could implement these types of policies. I don't see it. I mean, this is the sixth year. I've been in three different administrations, and you do kind of get a lame duck once the election for 2016 really kicks off. There's not a lot that they're going to be doing, and I don't see real fire in the belly for paid maternity leave anywhere here.
We're talking with Judith Barnett. She is a former government employee, in fact, high-level government employee, and now is a business consultant and a lawyer. She wrote in the Huffington Post, "An American outrage, having babies on sick leave, wondering why the U.S. is one of only four countries in the world to not give women paid leave to have children." Well, you wrote about a little history of subsidized care for children and families, noting that the last time it was done on any wide scale was during World War II. Can you give us the details?
Yeah, I mean, in World War II, women needed to go into the factories. I mean, I lived in Detroit after World War II, and women still talked about those happy days where they could pack off and go help the war effort. Well, they also had children. So what the government did was to develop federally subsidized child care centers. And then the private sector took over. So they supplemented, like the Kaiser factory. I had wonderful child care centers with a doctor on call at all times, with nurses, with food. And this doesn't all need to be subsidized by the U.S. government. It needs to be seeded by the U.S. government and let private industry supplement it.
Okay, so after Rosie the Riveter returned home, so did the subsidized child care.
Right.
Another proposal in 1972. What happened then?
Well, that was a proposal under the Nixon administration, and it was in 72 the Congress passed, with pretty strong bipartisan support, something called the Comprehensive Child Care Development Act. So this would have been a national network of federally funded child care centers, but President Nixon was having none of it, but his wording was what really depicted a lot of the thought of that time. He said, "Implementing a communal approach to child rearing would have family weakening implications."
Uh-huh. Yes, of course, that's what they do in Russia, right?
Right. And let me just say that, you know, the reality now is that 63% of families with kids have either two working parents or a single parent. The majority of families, a big majority now, don't have a stay-at-home parent to provide child care. And the people hit really the worst are families below the poverty line. They spend 30% of their income on child care, whereas those above the poverty line spend 8%.
Well, Judith, you were once in government, we noted, but now you work as a lawyer and a consultant in international trade, and you specialize in the Middle East. I'm curious, you know, what do your colleagues in the Middle East think when you talk to them about America's maternity leave policy?
Well, as I've said in the article, it was just such an ironic statement when I think it was actually a male colleague who said that the next time my American friends talk about our deplorable status of women, I'm going to tell them that, I think what he said, Arab monarchies don't demand that women be sick to deliver the future. I mean, there are all sorts of things, problems in countries throughout the Middle East, but all of them allow paid maternity leave. All of them honor pregnancy. They honor pregnant women, and they want their women to be strong at least during the time. I mean, there are problems with women working and women driving and stuff, and so on and so on in some of those countries. But they at least see this moment of pregnancy as something that's critical to their countries.
Well, Judith Barnett, thank you for speaking with us.
You're just more than welcome. Thank you.
That's Virginia Prescott speaking with Judith Barnett about her article for the Huffington Post, "An American Outrage, Having Babies on Sick Leave." Now, take a moment and think back to the very first photograph ever taken of you. Probably somebody cleaned you up a little, put you in your very first onesie before snapping that welcome to the world picture. But these days, more and more babies are being captured on film before they have their first feeding or first swaddling. Rebecca Shear brings us this story of a photographer who captures the very frontier of childbirth.
Washington, D.C. resident Emily Goodstein has been to more hospitals than most people.
I've been to GW Hospital, Virginia Hospital Center, Sibley, and Holy Cross Hospital.
But she hasn't been a patient or a doctor or a nurse. No, she's been...
These are the photos from baby May's arrival.
A photographer.
Every time I go through the photos, I cry just as much as I did at the birth itself.
Emily's part of a growing movement of birth photographers. The International Association of Professional Birth Photographers reports having more than 860 members in 24 countries, all hired by expectant moms to capture their labor and delivery process on camera.
So this is a picture we're looking at right now of Joanna and her baby and then her doula with the doula's hand sort of on Joanna's leg. And I have noticed that I actually get a picture quite similar to this at all births. It's funny the types of things that repeat themselves.
Emily's start in professional photography came with another milestone life cycle event, weddings.
Photographing weddings was fun and people were happy, but I was getting a little burnt out. And I came across a blog, actually of a photographer who's based in Utah, who had photographed a birth. And I thought, this is weird. People have professional photographers at their birth?
That was 4 years ago.
And I know that because the first baby that I photographed being born is now four.
The birth happened at Virginia Hospital Center.
It was a beautiful birth. And I walked out of the hospital. And I remember I was standing in the driveway of Virginia Hospital Center with all my gear. And I had amniotic fluid on my sweatpants. And I felt like I was so sort of on my purpose.
Since then, Emily's had 20-some birth clients, including the mother whose photos we were looking at earlier, Annandale resident Joanna Eddy, who had her first home birth in the wee small hours of the morning last month.
I could not believe it. I didn't think I could do it.
But you did, and you were heroic and speedy.
I thought I was going to be at the hospital, honestly.
Emily Goodstein knows some parents may not feel comfortable bringing a professional photographer into their homes or delivery rooms. But as Joanna Eddy relaxes on her bed nursing her newborn for the very first time, she tells me she wouldn't have had it any other way.
It's just this beautiful, monumental time.
And I think that to be able to look back and see that in photos will make a lot of difference in the processing and the healing that I think all women do, regardless of their birth experience. So I think that we'll really cherish them more so than I even think in this moment when I'm able to really think about what just happened.
Emily Goodstein aims to stay as in this moment as possible so she can tell a more complete birth story.
I usually will have spoken with the client in advance and I know exactly what they're looking for. And I don't guarantee ever a specific photograph, but I try to weave the photos together to tell the story of early in the labor and meeting the baby for the first time and the siblings meeting for the first time and all that good stuff.
Still, though, she's clear what her priorities are.
I always say to the care team, my priority is for you to be able to do your jobs. My second priority is to get photos. I want to be the second priority, right? My first priority clearly is healthy mom and healthy baby.
Which is why she takes certain precautions.
Whenever I meet a new member of a care team, I always say, hey there, I'm Emily. I'm the birth photographer. I was hired by the parents to be here. Please let me know if I'm in the way. Are you comfortable if you're in the background of a few photos? And, you know, I won't take it personally if you have to elbow me out of the way. So I try to be extra respectful in that regard.
Emily's captured many a birth on film, but she hasn't always been allowed to document the actual delivery.
Every hospital has a different policy, and every doctor or midwife has a different policy. So there have been two deliveries that have resulted in C-section, and I've given my camera to the dad or to the doula. I did recently also have a twin client who labored in a labor and delivery room, but then pushed in an OR in case there were any complications. And so I wasn't actually allowed in the OR.
And yet, she says, the inherently unexpected nature of things makes her love her job all the more.
There is that thrill when, you know, a mom is pushing and her baby is born. And even I had one client this fall who actually caught her baby. And I have a beautiful photo of her sort of lifting the baby out of her. So, yes, I would love to be there when the baby is coming out. But if that's not possible, we can still get really beautiful photos.
And the truth is, that's actually what happened with Joanna Eddy in Annandale. As Emily does with all her clients, she put herself on call 2 weeks before and after Joanna's estimated delivery date.
When I'm on call, I always have a bag ready, clear memory cards, charged batteries, high-protein snacks. The longest time I've been with a client is 36 hours.
So she was totally ready to go. But remember what Joanna said about thinking she was going to be at the hospital? Well, this was her first home birth, something she'd really wanted after delivering her first child in a hospital. But once her water broke, she got kind of nervous, started having second thoughts, and one thing led to another. The birth team focused on calming her down. And the labor happened so quickly that the next thing you know, they were calling Emily to tell her it's a girl. As Emily explained during our early morning drive to Annandale, this was only the second time she'd missed a delivery.
The other one was born while I was parked in my car. So that one is in the gray area. Right? Because I was on...
You were technically there.
Exactly. Yeah. I was there. I just didn't have my camera on.
This time she did have her camera on for quite a lot, like the umbilical cord burning ceremony Joanna's birth team did in lieu of a cord cutting.
That's some serious cordage, girlfriend.
And the moment 3-year-old big sister Vivian met baby May for the very first time.
Do you want to come see her? You gotta be really careful. She's
my baby.
It is your baby.
It's my baby.
It's moments like these, Emily Goodstein says, that make the whole thing so magically worthwhile.
Every time I'm at a birth, I see it as a celebration of a woman making a choice about her body, or a series of choices about her body. So when and how many children to have, and how to bring children into the world. And the fact that I get to be there to celebrate that, I actually feel like it's an honor when people allow me to be with them on the day that they meet their child.
And what's more, she says, to help them remember so many little things about their big day. I'm Rebecca Shear.
Rebecca Shear is the host of Metro Connection on WAMU in Washington, D.C. And we'd love to hear from you about this story. How do you feel about bringing a professional photographer into your home or delivery room during labor? Is it a moment that should be captured on film or that should remain private? Tell us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And coming up next, we'll tackle the birth of one of America's most popular non-carbonated beverages, Gatorade's humble and fascinating beginnings when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. 50 years ago, if you were an athlete practicing or playing in the unforgiving heat of summer, water breaks were unthinkable.
Well, did you ever hear of giving a hot, sweaty football player all the cold drink he wants? Never.
The belief was the longer you could stay off of anything, the better your performance would be.
And the longer you play without it, the tougher you are, and the tougher you are, the meaner you are, and the meaner you are, you'll be the better player.
So anybody that said, hey, coach, can I have a water break, was perceived to be a little bit less than tough.
It's a wonder we all didn't cramp up and die.
That's a clip from a new ESPN 30 for 30 documentary called The Sweat Solution, which chronicles the history of Gatorade. The drink began as an experiment to help the Florida Gators football team stave off debilitating dehydration during practice. 50 years later, Gatorade's now the largest, most successful non-carbonated beverage in the U.S. Neil Amder is co-director of the documentary, and he joined Virginia to talk about the surprising history of the popular sports drink.
So tell us about Robert Cade. He is the doctor who invented Gatorade. A little on his background.
Well, he is truly a Renaissance man, someone whose interests were as diverse as Studebakers, collecting Studebakers, playing the violin, growing flowers, and also just an excellent source of energy and enthusiasm for renal medicine, which he brought to the University of Florida when he came there in the early 60s. And he assembled a team of researchers. And in response to the Florida football team's need for solving this dilemma that they had of players going to the hospital with dehydration and loss of 20 pounds as much in a workout in the summer, Dr. Cade, this quirky little guy, decided to create a solution that has become and changed the whole face of sports training.
So how did he test it, and who did he test it on?
Well, what happened was, what was interesting, the coach at the time, Ray Graves, wouldn't allow Dr. Cade and his researchers to work with the varsity players, but he would allow them to experiment with the freshmen. So they literally bottled the sweat of the players who were in sweatsuits and gloves and to try to find out what was in the sweat that they could replenish. And after looking through it and deciding what they had to replace, they came up with a solution that initially tasted so bad that the players themselves really, really hated drinking it. It was Dr. Cade's wife, Mary, who had suggested changing the solution to a lemony kind of taste. And so what they did was they squeezed lemons one night and brought that solution back to the players. P.S., Gatorade as we know it.
It's just such a funny little clip in the film where his wife just says, add lemons.
Yeah, she's a terrifically interesting woman, and the daughter, Phoebe Cade Miles, who is now launched and has put into play the Cade Museum in Gainesville for research and development, is an extension of Dr. Cade's contributions to medicine.
Well, what is the secret to Gatorade? Why does it actually work?
I think probably the solution is that they came up with what actually was being lost in athletic performance. And water was not necessarily the most conducive in the sense that you tended to get heavy-weighted. And I think the Gatorade got through your system much faster so that the players could respond to that. And what happened was when they tried this with the varsity in 1966, the football team, not only did they have a Heisman Trophy winning quarterback in Steve Spurrier, but the team was winning these comebacks in the second half of football games, and people were astonished when they went 7-0, went to a national ranking, and how did they do this? And that's when I wrote the first story on Gatorade in 1966 for the Miami Herald.
Wow, so you were really early on this one.
I was covering the Florida football team, and some of the opponents were kind of startled at how the Gators looked so fresh in the fourth quarter. And I had gotten a lead when I was up there one weekend and talked to Dr. Cade, and he explained this to me. And I wrote the story in the Herald. And then, of course, what happened was one of the great mysteries, which is in the film, interestingly enough, somehow or another, when they went to play the University of Georgia in their rivalry in Jacksonville, the Gatorade never arrived for the game. And no one could figure out whether the truck that was sending it got hijacked, whether there was some other mysterious circumstances. But the players didn't have the Gatorade. P.S., they lost after leading at halftime. They were beaten badly 27-10. And that's when the myth of Gatorade continued to expand as to something that could improve athletic performance.
And Neil, did you try it way back then?
Oh, yeah. I was one of Dr. Cade's pupils, in a sense, because I wrote other stories about his involvement. He was also early on developed carbohydrate loading, which marathoners now do with pasta.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Cade substituted steak for, he would put what he called Gator Go, which was a high carbohydrate pancake-like breakfast for game day instead of steaks, and the players responded to that, and Gator Go became kind of legendary. And he fooled around with a hydraulic football helmet that he created, and he would have some of the players bang him on the head with a hammer to
oh
see whether
goodness.
It would help concussions. That was Dr. Cade, who was quite a remarkable Renaissance man, and I think has gotten the recognition now that he deserves over the years for his contributions.
We're talking with the veteran sports writer and editor Neil Amder about a film that he co-directed about the history and origins of Gatorade, truly a revolutionary drink in the world of sports. How did it make the jump from the Florida Gators football team to mass marketed to the general public for dehydration?
Interesting question, because in the film, Dr. Cade is quoted as saying that they never really made the drink for and never thought that they would be taking this to the general public. But I think when the word got out that Florida had this solution that was developed. What happened was Dr. Cade, who wanted it obviously to be something that would benefit, and interestingly enough, in the film as well, there's a segment when his daughter and a nurse talks about how Gatorade was being used at Chan's Hospital, a children's hospital in Gainesville, for newborn babies who were also suffering severe dehydration. And this is something that became instituted into the general medical practices in using Gatorade and that type of electrolyte solution to help with that. And I think what happened was other schools started to get the word out on Gatorade, and they started to develop it. And then they created a Gatorade Trust among the researchers there, sold the product initially to Stokely Van Camp, which began to market it, and subsequently it started to grow from there. And it has continued to grow over the years, and the statistics don't lie. I mean, in 2001, they had sold 339 million cases of Gatorade. Yeah. In 2013, which is the last year that they had it, they sold 632 million cases. So the increase is significant at a time when a lot of other of the sugary drinks are losing among health-conscious consumers. And here is Gatorade, which is continuing to show growth.
Well, we're talking about hydration all the time, not just for people who are engaged in sports, but it really is difficult to imagine a time when staying hydrated was not mandated for athletes.
I think it's definitely true. And I think part of what the evolution of these, a lot of the different sports training techniques developed. I mean, today it would be so much more difficult under NCAA regulations for a coach to authorize an experiment on a campus using football players as so-called guinea pigs in an experiment,
right,
keeping in mind this was 1965. But I think what is happening is that when you have visionaries who are able to see through these kinds of things and are able to see the benefits, you're seeing it in a lot of other areas as athletes become much more attuned to weight machines today than they were, let's say, back in the 60s when maybe they jog a little. Now everyone is into year-round conditioning, staying in shape. Much more weight training is done out of the season than it was done. And I think we're getting better athletes. We're getting more finely tuned. You're getting more women involved with marathons and training today than we've ever had before. And I think this is a sign that the public has become much more health conscious.
Well, you're also bringing up another point for me. I mean, when I was watching it, I couldn't help but think of Deflategate, right? It's going on now. And for the first time realizing, for me, I never thought about how an underinflated ball could make a huge difference. So 50 years ago, they didn't consider hydration. I'm thinking, Neil, you know, 50 years from now, are we going to hear about something that we wouldn't have thought of that's become the norm? You know, 50 years from now, are we going to hear, no, you're not supposed to stretch after working out?
I think it's evolving all the time. And a lot of times when you hear different training techniques that people are using and recommending, they'll tell you about, you know, running and its ills, let's say, versus some other cardio type, running on a Stairmaster or on an elliptical machine. People who are running, let's say, trying to run marathons, you know, 10 or 12 marathons, and then they wonder why they have a knee replacement or a hip replacement. I've never run a marathon. I've been running for 40 years, but I've run a couple of half marathons, and I'm still running today. And the great thing about it is that I think probably if I had been running marathons instead of reporting on them, I might have broken down myself. I would rather, in the long run, continue to have my healthy experience, at least as I go. And I think those are the fine lines that people draw up, and you have to figure out where your limits are.
Well, Neil Amter, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure, and best wishes to you, and stay warm up there.
Thank you.
That was Virginia Prescott speaking with Neil Amter, co-director of ESPN's new 30 for 30 documentary called The Sweat Solution. And we move now from the history of Gatorade to a relatively unknown but still very important chapter of football history in 19th century America. The story comes to us from Brian Ballow, Ed Ayers, and Peter Onuf, hosts of the radio show Backstory with the American History Guys. Take it away, guys.
It begins in 1893 at the Carlisle Indian Boarding School in Pennsylvania. The superintendent of that school, a man named Richard Henry Pratt, had banned the game of football a few years earlier after one student had broken his leg in a game. But now, at the urging of a number of young men at the school, Pratt was beginning to see football in a new light.
What he saw in it was a very sort of modern sport.
This is historian David Adams, author of a book about Indian boarding schools. David says that in the 1890s, football was widely thought of as a complex, strategic, and modern sport. This image was helped along by the fact that the most advanced schools, schools like Harvard, Yale, and Brown, also had the best football teams.
So his idea was that if Indians could display their equality on a football field, they in fact would display their ability to totally assimilate into the culture. And so Pratt saw this as a way of advertising his model of Indian education.
Pratt's model of education had one core objective, to Americanize Indians by removing them from their family cultures.
I guess we would call him a radical assimilationist. He believed that Native American cultures were worthless, but he believed that there was not any inherent genetical defect in Indians. And so he believed they could be fully integrated into the American scene. And he saw football as a means of doing that.
So Pratt agreed to create a team with two conditions. One, that his boys play fair. And two, that they whip the best teams in the country. It worked. The Carlisle Indian School team took to the gridiron and consistently beat college football juggernauts for the next 24 years. They were fast, strong, and strategic, working within the loose rules of the early game.
Carlisle was famous for outfoxing the opposition. One of the trips when they were playing Harvard, for example, in one year, they actually shoved the football up the back jersey of one of their players, and all the players could rush down the gridiron, and Harvard didn't know who had the ball. And so they scored a touchdown that way.
But if Pratt's main objective with all of this was to make the general public view his students as regular Americans, well, that just didn't happen. That's because the press took the spectacle of an Indian football team playing white teams, and they ran with it.
They begin to see football, in a sense, as a replaying of a frontier conflict.
All the manifold interests of present and the past, the near and the far, were collected on the instant on Soldier's Field.
This is from the Boston Globe, when Carlisle took on Harvard in 1896.
Over 500 years of education were represented by the young palefaces in crimson, while centuries of fire and sun worship, medicine men, incantations, ghost dances, and mound building were flashed before the inner vision by the appearances of the young men from Carlisle.
The number of cartoons in which they were displaying football players going after scalps, for example, was certainly...
Oh, come on. They literally were going after scalps?
Yes, there's one cartoon, in fact, and it shows an Indian with headdress and scalping knife, and he's looking at a Michigan player with a helmet on, and under the cartoon, the Indian is saying, "How am I going to get that fellow's scalp?" And that's, of course, because of the helmet. So,
oh, boy.
They were fighting things like that.
In spite of this setback, in public, Pratt celebrated the immense popularity of his team. After all, it turned out athletic legends like Jim Thorpe, and it toured the nation, marching in parades and staying in the nicest hotels all over the country.
Anytime that the games were played on neutral territory, in other words, not on the college campus of Yale or Harvard, but in neutral territory, and they were often played in New York City and in Boston, the white crowd, they were always cheering for the Indians.
The grand irony of all this, says Adams, is that the team was popular precisely because it mapped so neatly onto a storyline that cast Indians as noble savages who had been vanquished in the march of Western civilization.
This is this sort of the romantic image of nature's nobleman And so there was this tendency for many of the fans to identify with the Indians. And the beauty of it was that you already had the land, okay? So, I mean, because football is a game about territory. And so you can cheer.
I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, it lines and boundaries and territory. And so on the fans could watch this game, cheer for the Indians who'd been terribly wronged. In the meantime, they had lost the land. So it was sort of a win-win situation.
After some of the best seasons that any team of the era racked up, Carlisle's successes on the field eventually faded away. But the 19th century warrior image that was so associated with the team most certainly did not. You're probably aware of the controversy swirling around today's Washington Redskins. Well, team owner Dan Snyder has defended the continued use of the name by saying it was coined by a Carlisle football alum, a guy named Lone Star Dietz. Here's Snyder on ESPN's Outside the Lines.
Coach Dietz was Native American. He named the team. The historical facts are the historical facts.
It's not clear that that was the case. Scholars have suggested that Dietz faked a Native identity for himself in order to take advantage of various opportunities for Indians at the time. But Adam says that by invoking Lone Star Dietz to defend the name, Dan Snyder is playing on the same romanticized notions that fans and sports writers held in the heyday of the Carlisle football team.
He's tapping in, I think, into the sports writers' desire or tendency to sort of want to replay Indians of another age, which is in contradiction to what Carlisle was trying to do.
That story came to us from Backstory with the American History Guys. You can learn more about that show on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. And don't forget, you can also follow us or send us your feedback or even share your ideas for the program on our Facebook page or on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.